The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and FESHRIFT in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, Adrian Harewood sat down with me to talk about his experiences as a student activist at McGill University in the late 1980s. This was recorded on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University.
So my name is Adrian Harewood, and I am a resident of Ottawa, a lifelong resident of Ottawa. I currently work as a journalist at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I've been there working at CBC Ottawa since 2006. I began as the host of the afternoon program All in a Day, which I served as a host for 3 years. And I'm currently in my 9th year as the co-anchor of the CBC Ottawa News at 6.
Where did you first hear about what was happening in South Africa and sort of what shaped your thinking about the issue?
It's hard to say because I'm old. I'm 47 now, turning 48 this year. And so it's hard for me to remember exactly when I first learned about South Africa. But what I can say is that I was born in 1970 to parents who were from the Caribbean, who had come to Canada in the 1950s and the 1960s to attend university. Both of my parents were educators. My dad ended up being a professor of classics at Ottawa U, and my mom's specialty was in linguistics, and she taught at Algonquin. But in addition to being educators, they were very active community people. Both of my parents were journalists as well. So they worked as journalists for the leading black newspaper in the 1970s and 80s. It was called Contrast. It began, I think, in 1969. So my parents were heavily involved in community and heavily involved, you would say, in black activism and the kind of Canadian civil rights movement. So as a kid, I was exposed to a lot of these issues through the paper. As I said, both my parents were columnists for that newspaper. So as soon as I could, I've been told stories that as a kid, I used to pore through newspapers. Like apparently when I was 5 and 6 years old, I'd be looking at the newspapers, looking for my parents' byline. And I can recall, you know, South Africa being a very prominent issue, certainly in the 1970s. 1976, of course, the Soweto riots. The next year, Stephen Biko is killed, is murdered. I think maybe I can relate to you this story, because I must have been about 6 years old. And at the time, and this may sound a little strange, but at the time, the best fruit store in the world was in Ottawa, and it was called Top Banana. And I was a kid that adored fruit. I loved all kinds of fruit, mango and papaya and kiwi. And so I can recall going into Top Banana and walking through the aisles, and I looked at I think it was like a navel orange, and I started reaching for the orange. Remember, I'm about 5 or 6 years old, so I can barely reach, reaching for the orange. And I hear a voice saying, "Put that back." And I'm looking around, and I can't see what's going on. It seemed as if it was like the voice of God or something, wondering, where is this voice coming from? And so, of course, I try reaching for the orange again, and this time the voice says it louder, "Put that back." And I still can't see the person. And so I reach one more time, and I'm reaching for the orange, and the voice says, "Put that back. We don't buy fruit from South Africa." And the voice was the voice of my father. And we were a family that boycotted all South African products. So my father at that time was basically telling me that, you know, despite the fact that I was 6 years old, and despite the fact that we lived thousands of, you know, at that time we used the term miles, not kilometers. So despite the fact that we live thousands of miles away from South Africa, that we had a responsibility to be in solidarity with these folks, mm-hmm. and that we had a relationship with them. And so I think my father at that time, in his own way, even though I was six, was teaching me about empathy. He was teaching me about solidarity. He was teaching me a political lesson as well, that it was required that you make certain sacrifices in order to demonstrate that you were actually supportive of, you know, a community that was being oppressed. You were supportive of that cause. And so until I was 23 or 24, I think it was really 1994, when I had my first orange from South Africa. Because I did not touch anything. I did not. That was just the way things worked in our family. So I think my first exposure to South Africa, like the issue of apartheid in South Africa, was in the 1970s, around 1976. Yeah, and so what I can also say is that I can recall also seeing news about other boycotts. As I mentioned, my parents are from the West Indies, and you know, if you're a West Indian, you have to be a cricket fan. You know, that's just part of being West Indian. And I can recall at various points some West Indian cricketers going to South Africa. They were regarded as being these kind of renegades, and they were regarded as being mercenaries, and they were ostracized because of that choice that they made. And so, you know, I can remember as a kid somehow knowing a bit that there was something about South Africa that was critically important. And then also, you know, in the early 1980s, things like Sun City, you know, I think it was Bruce Springsteen was part of that grouping that had that song, "We're Not Going to Play Sun City," which was that kind of Las Vegas type center in South Africa where a lot of people went to gamble and to cavort and have, you know, good times. And I can remember that song being a bit of an anthem. And there was a lot of popular culture at the time, which, whether it was in music or films, that kept the issue of, you know, white supremacy and the anti-apartheid project at the forefront at the time. So it was hard to live in the 1970s and 1980s and not be aware of what was going on in South Africa.
And then you went to university and became involved in the anti-apartheid movement on campus. Can you tell me about what kind of activities you were involved in? What organizations?
Yeah, so I went to, my first year at McGill University was in 1989. And I was enrolled in history and political science. I did kind of political theory. That was really my focus. And so my first year, I played soccer. So I played on the varsity soccer team. But at the same time, I think it was probably that fall, I joined the Black Students Network, which at the time was a very, considered the most active political, I would say, group on campus. And it was comprised of some really remarkable individuals, some remarkable organizers. And the BSN also was linked with the Southern Africa Committee. And in fact, both of the groups were housed in the same office. So soon after, and I don't know exactly when it happened, soon after joining the Black Students Network, I also became a member of the Southern Africa Committee. And I eventually became the chief librarian. We started a library. I'm not remembering what year. It must have been around maybe 1991, possibly. But we started a library, a resource center at McGill. And the idea at the time was that we were trying to, you know, we were the kind of organization that didn't want to just isolate itself within the university. We felt that it was incumbent upon us to have a connection with the community, and we wanted to bring the community into the university. And so the idea was to start this resource center that would serve students and community members. So I was the librarian. I helped to start the library, and it was a library that served in both the BSN community and the Southern Africa Committee. And so I was responsible for, you know, selecting various materials and cataloging the materials and disseminating the information. And there was a lot of interaction and crossover between those two groupings. So many of the people who were in the BSN were also part of the Southern Africa Committee and vice versa. And at that time, this was pre-internet. And so this was a time when, you know, it was a time when you used to hand out information all the time, like articles and pamphlets and the like. And so I would spend a lot of time in the McLennan Library going through various publications sometimes, you know, to get access to stuff we didn't have at the BSN. So whether it was reading, you know, journals like Race and Class, which came out of the Institute for Race Relations in London, I would photocopy, you know, articles pertaining to South Africa, and we would pass them out to people, our friends, colleagues, just anyone that we thought would find it interesting. Also at the time, I can remember the South African Communist magazine was really a treasure trove of information, and it was probably the most critical publication that we had access to that delved a little deeper and gave us a much more, it was much more analytical and much more substantive than anything we had access to. So that was another publication that I spent a lot of time reading and then subsequently copying and handing that information out as well. So that was part, I suppose, of my role. Like my role was to be, I don't want to say a proselytizer necessarily, but more of a facilitator, of maybe an educator of sorts, just trying to raise people's consciousness about what was going on. It wasn't just in South Africa, but yeah, South Africa, we spent a lot of time, you know, talking about South Africa and sharing, spreading the word about South Africa.
Can you tell me more about maybe other organizations you might have partnered with? A lot of the movement was done through coalition work. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, were there any other civil society organizations or actors that you worked with?
Yeah, we worked with, within the, on campus, we were really aligned with the Palestinian student grouping. It was also a very, very active group. I would say the BSN, the Southern Africa Committee, and the Palestinian group were the most radical and the most engaged and the most prominent organizations on campus, I would say, at that, for about a 3-4 year period. And so we worked very closely with them on a number of different initiatives. We worked with, if I remember correctly, the Women's Center as well. You know, before that term intersectionality, you know, there was a lot of interaction with even groupings like the Sexual Assault Center on campus. They were often supportive of our various initiatives, the Women's Center. You know, within civil society, there was a grouping called AKAX, which was kind of a, I would say, a kind of a SNCC, like Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, / Black Panther type organization that existed in Montreal in the late 80s, early 90s, that had done a lot of organizing around police brutality. And so, you know, we certainly had connections with that group. And if not kind of overt organizational connections, you know, there were members of our group who were part of AKAX. And so there was that kind of natural communication that was going on. Yeah, that's the one other organization. And of course, there were a number of left organizations, progressive organizations that were often at our events or, you know, demonstrating their solidarity in various ways. I'm just trying to remember that. I'm not remembering the name of the grouping, but it was the grouping that produced the newspaper called The Militant. It was a socialist organization. I'm just not remembering the name of it. But generally speaking, you know, most of the active socialist groupings were very supportive.
Can you recall any points of maybe disagreements or division within these partnerships?
I can't recall that right now. I should say that by the time that we arrived, like by the time my cohort arrived on the scene in 1989, a lot of the heavy lifting around South Africa, particularly on campus, had been done, I would say. And that's not to say that we didn't do, you know, I think important work and critical work. But in terms of the, like, for example, the divestment campaign that happened at McGill, a lot of that work was done like in the mid-80s, maybe like 1985. 1985 was a big year, and McGill was one of the first, I think McGill might have been the first organization, first university to divest from South Africa. And that was a kind of a major struggle. And the members of the BSN and SAC had played a prominent role in that struggle. The BSN and the Southern Africa Committee came together around that time, because prior to 85, my understanding was that a lot of the folks who had been involved in this, or rather, there weren't as many black folks involved in the Southern Africa Committee prior to 1985. It was mainly, I think there were more white folks involved. And so it was almost like a conscious decision of some of the young black students to marry the two organizations and to have black people playing a more engaged role. And my understanding is that, you know, and having had recent conversations with some of the folks who were involved at that time, my understanding was that that was a conscious decision, because the feeling was that there was the need to heighten the struggle, I suppose. Like, mm-hmm. There was a feeling that maybe for a lot of black Canadians, their sense of what was going on in South Africa resonated in a different way. And so they articulated that. They articulated their feelings about South Africa, perhaps in a more overtly political, maybe a more aggressive manner. So all that's to say that I think a lot of that work had been done before we got there. And so by the time we were on the scene, a lot of the work that we were doing was about keeping South Africa at the forefront of people's imagination and trying to raise people's consciousness. It wasn't necessarily building organization in order to move the campus, because the campus had in some ways already been moved, mm-hmm. right? So those kinds of, we were engaged in alliance building, but we didn't necessarily have a political goal that we were trying to achieve on campus at that particular moment, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What about, what were your impressions of the liberation movements at the time? Did they have any role in influencing what was happening on campus or more broadly?
Yes and no. You know, I should go back, because my memory's starting to be jogged. I went to high school here in Ottawa. I attended a school called Ashbury College, and when I was in high school, my history teacher was a South African who had left South Africa in the 1960s because he was opposed to the regime. And so he was very, very, he was someone who was constantly bringing South Africa into conversation. And because we were in Ottawa, this is the capital of the country, so a lot of embassies are here and various other missions. So the ANC mission was here. And at the time, there was the head of the mission. There was a guy by the name of Victor Moshe. And so Victor came into our class on a number of occasions. So I met Victor Moshe when I was maybe 16, 17 years old. So the ANC was the organization that I think most people were aware of. And I would say on the McGill campus, the ANC probably had the most influence. I know, though, in places like Toronto, it was much more fractured. So that the PAC, Pan-Africanist Congress, which had been led by Robert Sobukwe, right, that was regarded at the time as being a more left, more nationalist, more of a black nationalist organization, and regarded in some quarters as being more militant. So I know that that organization had more prominence on the Toronto scene, and so maybe at places like U of T and York. But from what I recall at McGill, the ANC had more status, I suppose. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think Victor Moshe, from time to time, would come to Montreal, or representatives from the ANC would come and meet with student groupings. Yeah.
Right. How did you see the Canadian government responding during this time? This was obviously after the sanctions were introduced, but there was a lot of pressure at the time calling on the government maybe to implement them more fully, to add new sanctions, or even just to maintain existing sanctions. How do you feel they responded to pressure from the movement?
Well, it's hard to say. Like, it's hard to say exactly what moved the Canadian government. I know that John Saul has suggested that had it not been for movements on the ground, that, you know, they helped to kind of alter the dynamic, and they helped to inform the discourse. But even he says it's difficult. If I remember from the book, even he says it's difficult to identify the extent of it. But I certainly believe that the noise that was being made mattered. And, you know, prior to, you know, Canada had always played a somewhat, I'm going to say ambivalent, but a kind of a hard role. It was a difficult role to kind of pin down. Like, we'd always heard about, for example, the role that John Diefenbaker had played in the 1960s in trying to oust South Africa from the Commonwealth, and Diefenbaker had been framed as a hero in some ways for standing up to some of the other white settler nations like Australia and New Zealand and certainly the UK at the time, who were resistant to the idea of isolating South Africa. So we've grown up with that. That understanding of Diefenbaker's role. You know, Trudeau had been less, again, hard to pin down, although he had the kind of image of being in solidarity with revolutionaries, you know, in part because of his relationship with someone like a Fidel Castro. On South Africa, his role was a bit ambivalent, it seems. And so the Liberals were, they kind of talked out of both sides of their mouth, and he, I think Trudeau, if my understanding was correct, he believed in trade. I think he said something to the effect that you know, we can't on the one hand call out, condemn South Africa, and then also trade with them. And you know, it turned out that he did neither, basically. So by the time the 90s came, 80s, 90s, it seemed as if, when Mulroney came to office, I think in 1984, there was a lot of, on the South Africa file, I think there was a lot of skepticism about what position that he would take. I think he was seen as being someone who would have been initially maybe sympathetic to imperialism, in part because of his relationship also with Ronald Reagan in the United States. But eventually, it turned out that he was more, you know, he had more substance than perhaps people felt. And so, you know, I think as students, we tried to make as much noise as possible, and in just hoping that whatever we would do would impact our immediate environment and eventually would somehow affect change at the governmental level. We weren't really, I wouldn't say that we were engaged in any kind of lobbying of government. But I think that at a certain point, we were aware that Mulroney was willing to take up the cause, particularly, I think there were like some fairly heated exchanges that he had with Margaret Thatcher at a couple of key Commonwealth meetings. And I think that we respected that, you know, that activity on the part of Mulroney.
Did you feel that, you know, the anti-apartheid movement in Canada and elsewhere was successful?
Well, I think the goal was to end this regime and was to end, you know, a situation in which, you know, the majority of the population were not full citizens and were unable to exercise their full rights that should have been accorded to them as citizens. And so I think that goal was achieved, right? And it was achieved for all kinds of different reasons. I think the international anti-apartheid movement played a role in that. Again, it's hard to determine how much it influenced it, but I think that it certainly kept the pressure on the South African government. I think that the South African government, elements of the government, wanted to be seen to be legitimate and wanted to be able to participate in various international fora. And the fact that they were denied that opportunity, whether it was in terms of sports or whether it was in terms of academia, whatever the case might be, it was painful to those folks to feel as if they were international pariahs. So I think that the activity that we were engaged in did have an influence on particularly some of the elites within South Africa who were critical to creating space to have a dialogue with groupings like the ANC and the PAC. I think, and having spoken to some of my contemporaries who were in South Africa at the time, I can recall, in fact, a PhD student from South Africa who had come to Carleton for a semester, and having this conversation with him, we were about the same age, and he was saying that they were aware that people on the outside were pushing and were calling for change. And he said that it gave a lot of folks courage, and that kind of moral support was very, very important to them, knowing that they weren't alone, knowing that there were people who were willing to sacrifice as well. And it made them feel as if they were part of a larger family, a larger community, and helped to embolden them. So again, I don't know, it's anecdotal, it's not necessarily a large, I haven't conducted a large survey, but that was his experience. And, you know, I took from that, you know, perhaps our work mattered in some way. But I think also in terms of just raising the consciousness of Canadians and recognizing, like having Canadians recognize that the South African issue was their issue, and that there were in fact connections between the history of this country and the history of South Africa, whether it was Canada's involvement in the Boer War, but beyond that, the fact that a lot of South African politicians had been informed by the way in which Canada had treated and has treated its indigenous peoples. You know, that had informed, my understanding was, helped them also to conceive of the apartheid kind of structure or project, and vice versa. Like the Canadian government had also been, or various Canadian governments had been influenced as well by the situation on the ground in South Africa, and that had informed the way in which it had ultimately dealt with its indigenous people. So I think speaking to that and bringing that to the fore helped to deepen Canadians' understanding of how they were also implicated in the project. So, and I always think that that's a useful exercise. And I think that just generally speaking, I think just for a society, empathy is a very, very important, and this notion of solidarity, those are very kind of important ideas just as human beings. And I think that when you recognize the pain and the suffering and, you know, the desire for freedom being articulated by people who aren't necessarily in your community, but when you recognize that and honor that, I think somehow it kind of makes you a more human being, like it kind of enlarges your own humanity. And so I think that in and of itself is something worth cultivating, right? It makes all of our spaces more human. Like hopefully it means that we, you know, treat each other in a more respectful way, and that we recognize that all people deserve dignity, and that all people deserve to realize their full potential as human beings. So I think, you know, my own activity in the anti-apartheid movement has informed the kind of person that I am, the kind of journalist I aspire to be. And I think that most of the folks with whom I was involved at that time would probably say the same thing. And so it's influencing the world in all kinds of different ways that we'll never be able to quantify. But I think that it certainly, you know, helped to, you know, make us all a little bit more human, I hope. If there's one criticism, I think, of the movement, it's that I don't think we probably thought as much about what would happen after liberation, you know, after the end of apartheid. I think that there was so much focus on ending this dastardly regime that maybe there wasn't enough thinking and thought put into, well, what kind of society did we imagine and what were we trying to build? And I say we building, you know, I'm not a South African, but in terms of the kind of conversations that we were having around it, I'm not sure if we talked enough about that and talked about how perhaps we could be contributing to the conversation post-liberation. So I think that was probably a bit of a failing. You know, a lot of the groupings, unfortunately, disbanded or just didn't continue the work afterwards. And, you know, I think that also is unfortunate. We see that with a lot of different kind of liberation movements. Like when I think, for example, a good example would be, let's say, like the East Timor Alert Network, which had played a very, very active role in the 1990s in helping to eventually gain freedom for the people of East Timor. I think it played a critical role on the international scene, but also domestically within East Timor. But I think, unfortunately, again, that group also eventually fell apart. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, given all the experience that group had accumulated over time, keeping that grouping together somehow and maybe seeing how it could contribute to the discussion might have helped the situation in East Timor. And so similarly in South Africa. That's one maybe lament, because clearly the situation that exists now is not what many of us would have imagined. You know, too many people are still denied the opportunity to fully participate in South African society. Many of the people who control the levers of power, before 1994, are still in control of that. There have been, you know, it would be wrong to say that there haven't been changes in South Africa, because there have been changes. And certainly the black population plays a more active role in the political sphere and increasingly, like slowly in the economic sphere, but certainly it's not commensurate with their presence in the society. And, you know, there have been a lot of individuals within, or I shouldn't say a lot, there have been some individuals, including the new president, who have benefited enormously from the new dispensation in South Africa and have become millionaires and billionaires, while, you know, people are living in shanty towns and squalor, in spite of the fact that South Africa, you know, like a place like the Congo, was one of the richest places in the world in terms of the natural resources. So clearly there are all kinds of contradictions that have yet to be resolved, and so that would suggest that the struggle that we were engaged in then wasn't as successful as maybe we thought it was when, you know, Mandela won power in 1994. I guess what it suggests is that there's that old saying, la luta continua. So what it suggests is that the struggle for creating a kind of society, a community in which people can live well. You know, I think it was Thomas Hobbes who talked about the brutishness of life, and then there are too many people in South Africa who live lives of kind of quiet desperation, and so clearly we need to move to a time or space where people can be freed from that oppression that they're currently enduring.
This was an interview with Adrian Harewood, conducted by Michael Buchert on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.